Hello and welcome to Cage Club, two fans, 73 movies, one cage. Today's movie is Guarding Tess from 1994. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And this movie is billed as a comedy and sort of shot, at least in the beginning, like a comedy. But it's pretty heavy, not very funny, and then there's like a huge, huge tonal shift toward the end where things get really serious in a hurry.
Yeah, it felt very lighthearted throughout most of the film. It's definitely marketed as a comedy, at least I think so. You know, I was expecting to have a bunch of laughs. We're sort of around the time where Cage has made three comedies by now, so this looked like a much lighter affair, especially coming down from Deadfall last week.
Yeah, but it turns out that it's not really that at all. I mean, the quote-unquote comedy comes from this old woman basically just nagging Nick Cage for most of the movie. Nick Cage plays a Secret Service agent named Doug Chesnick, and he's tasked in Somersville, Ohio, I believe, to guard a former first lady. He loves his job, but he wants to get back in the action. Being stationed in Somersville, Ohio, living with an old lady and not having any danger is not the ideal job that he wants to have.
When the movie starts, he's been doing this for 3 years now, and we pick up on his last day of work, and he goes back to Washington for reassignment, and he's assigned right back to the first lady again. She actually requests that he come and guard her for another term of service.
Not only does she request it, but the president of the United States requests it, because he was a vice president to this woman's husband, and so he owes her a lot. He feels like basically she's part of his family, and he wants her to be happy, and wants to make sure that everything that she's doing, everything, you know, in her life is exactly as she wants. And if she wants Nick Cage to be her Secret Service agent, he's going to be the one that's tasked to guard her again for another tour.
Yeah, and you can't refuse the President of the United States, especially a guy in his position. So he sort of reluctantly hangs his head and heads back. This is sort of where we meet the little crew that works for the First Lady, right? She has like a little house full of people that are all the other characters in the movie, you know, sort of peppered throughout the house.
Yeah, she has her driver, she has her chef, she's got a couple other Secret Service agents. She's got a couple other sort of general help guys. I mean, the big ones, the ones that sort of have meaty parts, are the driver, played by Austin Pendleton, and the chef, who's played by the actor, I don't remember the actor's name, but played by the guy who plays Vernon Dursley, Harry Potter's uncle in the Harry Potter movies. There's a whole bunch of people around the house. It's this one woman, Tess Carlisle, and a bunch of guys just sort of taking care of her, and at the start of the movie, she just like never leaves her room. She never comes downstairs. She's sort of trapped in this life of just nothing and just sort of boring monotony, and you can tell why Cage wants to get out of there.
She's basically a shut-in. She hasn't really left her bedroom for a long time, and, you know, her husband, she's a widow, so her husband has passed and, you know, assumed for a while now. You know, we don't really know. She's sort of aloof at the start of this, and when Cage comes back, she kind of starts coming out of her shell a little bit, and lo and behold, we have a connection here. She wants to go to the opera.
She wants to go to the opera, and I sort of freaked out a little bit when we got to the opera connection. It's twice now. I mean, it's both Moonstruck-related, but we saw the opera was a huge part in Moonstruck, and then we saw that theme played again in Saturday Night Live, but the opera is a huge part of Cage's career, and they go back to the opera in this movie.
But unlike his character in Moonstruck, Doug hates the opera, or
does not like the opera.
Just doesn't care for it whatsoever. And he is just, he's really upset and angry and tense about this detail, you know, and he's sort of letting everybody know it, right? Like, he's pretty vocal and kind of speaking out. I don't know, almost wants to get kicked off this duty.
Like, the worst thing, I guess, in his mind is that he pisses everybody off enough that she's like, all right, you know what, just go back to Washington, I'm done here. He kind of explodes. He's really tired of just being a guy who carries food up and down the stairs to her, and he lets her know that, you know, he's a Secret Service agent. He's not just a waiter.
What does she want? Chocolate? Some kind of goddamn food drink or something? What do we look like, waiters? Are we a bunch of waiters? We want to be down there!
Everyone's sort of feeling the stress of this lady, but Cage is the only one that's really letting it get get to him. Everyone else is sort of writing her off as just eccentric and sort of changes her mind all the time. You know, one day she wants to go to the opera, the next day she wants to go play golf. She doesn't care that it's 30 degrees out and drags everybody out to the golf course. And Cage is trying to look, you know, I love it because I'm glad he's playing a Secret Service agent. I just wish he was playing one in the field somewhere else. But he's had such a tension on the golf course, you know, because there's so many potential threats. He's basically reduced to being a caddy and that's just not what he signed up for.
Would you be kind enough to get my first ball, please, Doug?
I'm a Secret Service agent, Mrs. Carlisle, not a caddy. You want that ball? I suggest you go get it yourself. And since you've insisted on me staying here, I think you should know I intend to do my job by the book, which means we don't run errands, we don't make snacks, and we don't check our guns at the door. Now, if you don't like any of this, I suggest you call Washington and get yourself a new man.
That's not what he signed up for at all. And I think that's sort of the whole point of the movie, right? That he's, like, we want to see him. He wants to be in this other role. We want to see him with more action. And we're sort of forced to live through the boredom, the same boredom that he has, just because he's living this life and doing this tour of duty that he calls, quote, the worst assignment in the service. He doesn't want to be there. We don't want to see him there, but we're all stuck in the same situation.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting how important this detail actually becomes. You know, the one thing that I think the movie does pretty well is it makes this detail seem very mundane and unnecessary, right? Like, what does she even need Secret Service for? But she's a former First Lady and a very recent former First Lady, so of course she may be a potential target or something of that nature, but the movie does do a good job of having the audience, or at least me, saying, yeah, she doesn't really need all this protection.
But you see, like, when they go to the opera, like, she's a big deal.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like,
right.
People see her falling asleep at the opera, and they're more intent on watching that than watching the show. When she's leaving the opera, there's a huge crowd that knows she's there and just waiting for her to leave. Like, she doesn't really need a Secret Service detail, but it's also, she's a level of notoriety or a level of celebrity or a level of fame that's too much just for a 60 or 65-year-old woman to handle on her own without some kind of security detail.
Yes, and there's a nice moment at the opera, too. There's a large crowd of people that they have to move through, and the Secret Service actually gets to go into sort of battle mode where they're being, you know, real Secret Service, and Nick Cage, you know, sort of sees this lady reach into her purse, and he cuts her right off and grabs her hand, and she was only reaching for a pen, and he sort of diffused that little situation. And I think the joke is, you know, no one's going to hurt this little old lady. You still get to see he's on his game, he's on point.
He's very competent at what he does, which makes it all the more frustrating that he's not able to do anything. And eventually, toward the end of the movie, when the sort of the big twist happens and the things start to fall into place, he actually does sort of get to exhibit the full range of Cage as Secret Service agent. But for the first, like, hour of the movie, he's really effectively neutered.
Yeah, he's always trying to tell the First Lady, this is the protocol, you know, you can't sit behind the driver, you gotta sit behind the passenger, or, you know, we have to leave at this. Like, he's sort of trying to keep her on schedule, and she just wants to live her life, you know, live the last days of her life the way she wants to. They're clashing in these early moments, too, right? And it makes me wonder, why does she want him back so bad if she doesn't necessarily like this guy very much or knows that he's going to bring this tension?
She's just comfortable with him. She doesn't want to have to go about everything. She's set in her ways. I think that she knows, and I think they might even have conversations about it in the movie, but she knows that this isn't the job that he wants to do, but she doesn't want to have to train a whole new staff. She doesn't know who she's going to get assigned. She knows him. She likes him. She wants her life the way she wants it and doesn't really care what that means to other people.
We also kind of see through some home movies later, well, not necessarily home movies, but she likes to watch old news reports and things of that nature. And Nick Cage's character pops up in those videos, so he may have been on her husband's Secret Service detail at some point, you know, just one of many, and then got assigned to her. So there could be that sentimental connection, and definitely by the end of the film, feelings come to light, right? Like, there's definitely a bond that's forged by the end.
Yeah, I mean, the real telling home video that we see is she's watching the huge funeral for her dead former president husband, and they cut to Cage in the audience. He's crying, like, he's really broken up. that he was, like you're saying, probably really close, probably on the security detail with her husband. He's kind of like a relic of her husband. Like, with him, she can sort of remember her husband, maybe. But even though she loves him, and, like, I think he understands why he means so much to her, Cage does not care, and they go to a diner. I think it's sort of the whole Secret Service team, you know, I guess after she's settled in for bed or whatever at night. He's just, like, bitching to them about how he's not a golf caddy, he's a Secret Service agent, and all this different stuff. And then there's a call from the President of the United States, and he wants to speak to Cage.
Hello?
Hello?
Hey, you, Doug?
Yes, sir.
How are you?
I'm fine, and you?
Well, I got this call from Tess Carlisle, and, I know this sounds a little crazy, but did you tear up some flowers of hers? Doug, you there?
Uh-huh, yes, sir.
Something about a bunch of roses.
Well, no. It wasn't a bunch, sir.
Uh-huh. Well, how many of them were there?
Just one, sir.
I see. And you tore it up, did you?
No, sir, I didn't tear it up.
Well, what'd you do?
I merely removed the bud.
From her flower?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, let's get past that for a second. As you know, I was her husband's vice president.
Yes, sir.
And frankly, I owe a lot to the Carlisle. She seconded my nomination. I think you know that, too.
Yes, sir.
So why don't we all try to get along a little better over there in Ohio, Doug? What do you say?
Yes, sir, absolutely.
I don't get it myself. One day she calls me, says she can't live without you. Next day she's calling almost in tears. So, you know, maybe you two have some kind of sicko thing going on.
No, sir. I can tell
but
you
I'll
that...
I'll tell you this, Doug. Any more phone calls from her and you're going to be guarding my dog. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes, sir.
Because I probably got the most important job in the world.
Yes, sir.
And I feel like a goddamn idiot having to call you about a goddamn flower. You know what I mean, Doug?
Yes, sir, I do. I certainly do.
So what do you say? You going to help me out on this one?
Yes, you can count on it, sir.
Thanks, Doug. That's what I wanted to hear. You have yourself a nice evening, son.
Yes, sir.
Night.
I mean, this is obviously one of the funnier moments of the movie. I like the way it played, too. I'm finding myself a little surprised with myself while talking about this movie, because I didn't have this much fun watching it, but I'm having fun talking about it. But he's in the bar sitting there, and he gets a phone call, and it's the President of the United States. And it's just, like, so shocking, and it instantly carries a lot of weight because he's calling this guy in a diner in the middle of nowhere, yeah. You know? And he's the President of the United States, so you gotta figure, like, he's in the middle of defusing a crisis here or there.
He has more important things to do.
Much. And he's basically like, you know, I got a call from Tess. What's the problem? Like, she's not happy, you know? I thought I could count on you. And, you know, that's when I was like, yeah, man, I hope you start to realize, like, it might seem like a cushy job, but this is like some super serious detail, you know, or at least people are counting on you. It's not a job for just anybody. You're there for a reason.
Now, did you know or did you read up who the President of the United States is in this movie?
I tried to guess just by listening, and when I couldn't figure it out, I wanted to wait for the podcast because I kind of figured you'd have the trivia on this.
It's not super exciting, but it's kind of cool. It is the writer and director of the movie. Hugh Wilson plays the president. It's really the most excitement because the president is really energetic and really emphatic, driving point home to Cage that, like, you need to take care of the situation. Like, it's not just a low-stakes situation. Like, this is still an important job, even if you don't think that. It's like this burst of life into this otherwise sort of boring movie. You're trying to figure out who it is, and just the writer-director, which I thought was kind of a cool little touch.
It's pretty funny that it's the writer-director because he's driving across the tone that he wants the movie to be. You know what I'm saying? Like, I feel like this president character comes into the movie to sort of propel these situations that are just lagging, or when the movie needs a kick in the ass a little bit,
yeah,
to propel it forward a bit more. Just that it's the director, it's funny, yeah, because he's getting across the tone that I expect the rest of this movie to follow, and it kind of doesn't.
What I kind of like is that he knows when the movie needs a little bit of a boost, and that's like when he inserts himself into the movie. Like, he can sort of sense that people are getting lulled into a little bit of a boredom, and so they have the president call, and he just gives this whole burst of life back into the movie. One other bit of trivia for this movie, and it's not something you can really guess, did you know that George Clooney apparently auditioned for one part in this movie, for a single line in this movie?
I'm trying to think of where that could... Do you know the role or the line or anything like that? Because I'm trying to think now where that could have been inserted. Maybe he played a news reporter and they cut to him on television when the crisis happens later on?
I don't know. They didn't have any more information about it. It's just that he auditioned. I don't even think they said he got the part. I don't know why at this point in his career George Clooney is auditioning for anything. It would have been funny if, like, the president was Clooney. You know what I mean? Like, he's just, like, this huge star. So by 94, Clooney had done ER. He'd done The Facts of Life. He'd been on Baby Talk and Roseanne and Bodies of Evidence and Sisters. He was about to do From Dusk Till Dawn, so maybe he was just like an up-and-coming or a really big TV actor?
I'd want it to be the helicopter pilot at the end that says that Doug needs to get on, that the First Lady's calling for him.
Maybe in that end scene when they keep, like, there's like a game of telephone when they're like saying his name, maybe one of those guys was just going to be Clooney.
That would have been awesome.
The first real sort of big thing that happens in this movie, aside from them going to the opera, is that they go out for a ride, and I don't think it's coming back from the opera, but it might be. Tess convinces her driver, apparently like she's done several times before, to just leave Cage behind. Like, they take two cars wherever they go, and it's Cage and the driver and Tess in one and everybody else in the other car, and they stop for gas or whatever. Tess convinces the driver just to take off and leave Cage behind, and they always, like, lose Tess. There's a sort of sense of irony that she forces Cage to stay in Ohio with her, yet all the time she's trying to escape him and leave him behind.
Yeah, I wish they set this up a couple more times, because it's supposed to pay off a bit later on, but you're right. She keeps playing, like, this cat and mouse game with him that has me wondering, is she sick in the head? Like, does she mean to be doing these kinds of things? There's a throwaway line about how she might be sick. Later on, she gets a CAT scan or an MRI, but still, even then, there's nothing conclusive about her health. But this part where she takes off with the driver is, I thought it was just supposed to be, haha, like, they're the worst Secret Service detail, they need local police to help do their job.
And I agree with you that they should have set it up a little bit more. And the only way that you really learn that this happens a lot is that they call the cops and, like, oh, you lost her again? Like, they say that it's happened, it seems like, a bunch of times, but they only show it once in the movie until the very end, and we'll get to this later. But when she actually gets kidnapped in a real weird tonal shift through this exact same way, that it would have been funny to see it happen at least maybe just one more time. But the fact that they do it once and then the second time is the big one is a little bit jarring, a little bit weird.
Right. They should follow the rule of three, you know?
Yeah.
This almost just felt like a setup for what would be a speakerphone joke, you know? Basically, he calls the cops, and he's like, I'm not on speakerphone, am I? And sure enough, all the cops listened in and heard the embarrassing phone call that Doug had to make, right? So it's basically just a setup for that joke. Later on, it becomes a very pivotal callback.
And this, like, joke that Tess is playing on him, like, infuriates Cage, and he, when everybody's back at the house, he erupts in a classic Cage eruption, fires the driver, who apparently has been fired several times before, that Tess promises him, hey, leave him behind, I'll make sure you don't get fired, and he just has this huge eruption that he can't deal with this anymore.
Blue, you know that?
No, I don't know that.
You don't know that.
No, I don't know that.
Why don't you know that? Oh, little cat,
buddy, come on. Because she assured me that I was not going to be fired, and in fact, I would have been fired if I hadn't done it.
Look.
You guys come and go, but I live here, and I keep my job because of her. You think I don't try to talk her out of these crazy things? But I got no choice.
Well, you're fired, girl. Trust me.
Yeah, I wasn't quite sure what the story was here, because he was allowed to fire the driver but not the chef or the gardener or those people, because they work for Tess. She hired those people, but the driver works for the Secret Service, so he's got the authority. I don't know why they went into all that. I mean, because he's not allowed to fire the driver in the end anyway.
Right, he sticks around.
Yeah, he sticks around. I think they needed to set up sort of sides here, right? That Tess has people on her side, and I don't know. We're definitely meant to feel empathy for this driver, because they're setting him up for later, too.
This whole incident, you know, firing the driver, getting angry at Tess for leaving him behind, sort of blowing up at her again, precipitates the next call from the president that Cage answers the phone. I guess when he's in his house, he's on the toilet. And it's just such a funny visual to see him on the toilet talking to the president of the United States about how bad of a job he's doing.
Yes, sir.
How are you?
I'm fine, sir. How are you?
Well, I'm not too good. I'm on my way to London. I'm supposed to be working on a speech for the common market. Instead, I'm having a goddamn pest Carlisle problem. What the hell's that about, Doug?
Do
you know that as of this morning, she has refused Secret Service protection? Where the hell'd she get an idea like that? This woman is a national treasure. Maybe you and I know what a pain in the butt she is, but we don't count. It's what the goddamn voters think. That's what counts. And they want this woman looked after. You understand me?
Yes, sir.
What if some lunatic breaks into her house and cuts her goddamn throat? What about that?
Well, I agree, sir.
Do you think I'd catch if something like that happened on my watch?
Yes, sir.
So let me make it real clear. Get over to her house and straighten this out. I'm counting on you, and so's the country. You hear me?
Yes, sir. I'll get on it right away.
Okay, that's what I wanted to hear. Thanks a lot, buddy. Hey, the next time you're in town, I want you to come over to the White House and have dinner with us, something like that.
Yes, sir. I'd be honored. I'll be there. Thank you.
All right. Have a nice day, pal.
Yes, sir, I will.
Here we go again with the director coming into his movie trying to remind us about what kind of movie it's supposed to be. This is a great visual with some great audio to go with it. You got Cage in his underwear on the toilet talking to the president of the United States. You know, he's caught with his pants down, literally.
Yeah.
And this is sort of the last charming moment of the film. This is sort of the last moment I'll give the movie. This is the last big funny moment it gives me.
Yeah, this is really like when the movie stops being a comedy, if it ever was a comedy to begin with. Like, what's so crazy is that like nobody wants to be bad at their job, but like when Cage is bad at his job, his boss is the president. He has to deal with like the most awkward and like embarrassing phone call that anybody could ever get. That the president has to take time out of his schedule. He's supposed to be flying somewhere to some summit or dealing with some crisis, and instead he's calling because his family friend Tess Carlisle isn't happy with her Secret Service agent. It's so dehumanizing and so humiliating that makes it extra funny.
Now that the Secret Service is sort of fired, Tess ditches the Secret Service for good, you know, doesn't need him by law, so decides not to have him. Doug and the Secret Service people basically decide to watch her anyway, right? They watch her on their own and sort of stake out her house.
They leave her house and the president says, hey, you got to get back in there, but she locks them out, right? She like closes the gate on them.
Yeah.
And all he wants to do is talk to her, but she's not letting them in, and it's just like this little bit of conflict. But like, what's also kind of more interesting in a similar but not exactly same kind of situation is that this is when Tess's son shows up.
Yes.
And I don't really understand what the purpose of him being in this movie is, unless they're setting him up that he's possibly the one who kidnaps her later. But it's just weird that he shows up as this like hotel tycoon or looking for an investment. We're looking for her approval so he can get an investment. I just don't understand why this is happening, and maybe you do.
I had one or two ideas about this scene because he's just in and out of this movie, but he shows up with like a land development deal for senior living, and he wants his mom's endorsement to make everything feel legit, you know? And you just get like he's such a shyster, like you just get like such a crooked vibe from this guy. At least I did right off the bat, and she doesn't do it for him. You know, she's like, no, I won't help you. I won't endorse your product, basically, is what she's saying. And you can just, I think we're just supposed to get the sense that she's really disappointed in her children, or at least in this guy. What she really wants is a son that's more like Doug, Nick Cage's character.
Okay.
I think we're supposed to see, you know, she's got this rotten kid, even though they don't, he's not that bad. You know what I mean? Like, I think that they want us to believe that this guy's done some bad business deals and maybe caused some shame on the president in the past, you know, as a kid or something. I think they're going in that direction.
I guess the other thing that this sets up is that this leads into her reminiscing, like we were talking about earlier, watching those home movies, transitions her or bridges the movie into this time where Tess is reflecting on her past, on her husband, on the life she once lived. And it seems like everything was better in the past, and that she really has nothing left to live for. Her son is not who she wants him to be. Her husband is gone. She's all alone. Her really closest friend in the world doesn't want to be there with her anymore. It's nothing is good in the present, everything is better in the past.
Yeah, I agree with that, you know, and it sets her up to be, like, this very sad lady, you know? Like, she's all alone there at the end, and she's not exactly trying to isolate herself either. There's wonderful sort of part in the middle where they're dedicating a library to her husband, and the president is going to show up. She's full of life again, and she gets her hair done, and she goes shopping, and then the president cancels, and it sort of drags her back down again. She was up for a moment, and then, you know, had the rug pulled out from under her.
I guess it's the fact that she had the rug pulled out from her by being disappointed in her son, by remembering that her husband is gone, or, you know, thinking about her husband. She sort of mellows out a little bit. And then she goes out with Cage, like she invites him in, he's sitting outside her house, and she comes out and she's really kind of low-key and mellow, and they go out to a bar, like a diner, and they're just getting a cup of coffee, and it's like at this point in the movie where you really see like the kind of woman that she really is, and the kind of woman that Cage would want to protect, right? Like she's just like a genuinely nice, down-earth woman, and not crazy, and not a shut-in. Like, this is the real test. Like, this is the great one that everybody loves or adored in the eyes of the public.
Yeah, I really like this moment, too, because, you know, she's dropped her guard completely. Like, not only does she not have any guards guarding her, but she's dropped her guard personally. Like, and Cage, too, you know? Like, he's not on duty, so they go out and they share a drink, you know, and they just talk to each other like normal people, right? And they finally realize we're fighting over nothing, pretty much, you know, like, and they're a team now, basically, from this point on. They accept each other.
They also talk about Cage's past. Like, they talk about how he was married for 7 months and it didn't work out. He was the only person who never saw what his wife truly was. Like, they don't really go too much into that, but they share this, like, really intimate moment. It makes you wish. I mean, I guess, like, the whole point of the movie is there's conflict between these two, but it makes you wish, like, their interaction was different because they have a real rapport and they have a real nice, genuine conversation here that you wish that, like, the hour or whatever that had preceded it had sort of played out a little bit differently.
Yes, I agree. See, here's where we get into the problem of it's not a comedy. This is sort of more drama-heavy, even if it's a lighthearted drama, sort of.
Right.
Even if it's like ABC Family level type of drama here. Okay, so when she goes to invite Cage for a beer, he's pouring coffee in his car and she scares him and he pours coffee all over his pants. That is the joke that we have, right? That's going to sustain us for the rest of the movie almost. Like, if the movie was more about an hour of them, how well they got along, how they're sort of this odd couple, they go shopping together, like he can read her mind, like he knows her so well, and you set up the comedy and the bond, and then, you know, you introduce like a problem or a conflict, you know, something that draws them apart or something that endangers one of the characters, that might be more of a comedic recipe than what we have.
But it's just not set up well. There's no reason for us to root for her. Like, she's not humanized. She's not shown to be like a likable person for so long. We have no choice but to sympathize with Cage. That, I mean, maybe he's exaggerating and maybe it's not the most redeeming character quality that he doesn't want to guard this old woman, but there's like nothing to say good about her, that she's like this off-kilter, self-centered, kind of manipulative old woman who just has nothing good about her.
Yeah, you're right. They just sort of have this talk and everything's forgiven and it's just a matter of screenwriting convenience that the characters are where the writer wants them to be for the next moment, you know? I don't know. There is a lack of consistency, I feel, with the Tess character throughout the film. However, it could be attributed to what we find out soon, that she does have some kind of sickness.
Yeah, so like early in the movie, when she's telling Cage that they're going to go to the opera, she says, one of these three things is true. She says something, I don't remember what it is. She says, I have a brain tumor, I have an inoperable brain tumor, and we're going to the opera tonight. And it's at that point, I was talking to Mike about it earlier, and we both agreed that, like, you know right there that she's sick, that she has a brain tumor. And as the movie goes on, you see her at the hospital. And so I guess it kind of explains why she's acting the way she's acting, but it still doesn't necessarily make us like her. We just can sort of feel bad for her.
Agreed. And if they had played up that she was sick a little more, then we would have liked her when she becomes manic or bipolar or however, whatever, whenever her just mood just starts to shift drastically. Like, if they had sort of hammered it home a little bit and made it more of the story, you know, the first lady, she's sick, we sort of need to hide that from the media, or that's why she doesn't go out so often, then maybe we care about her a little more.
I guess the good thing about the movie finally humanizing her and finally giving us a reason to like her and care about her is that it brings us to one of my favorite, if maybe not my favorite, scene in the movie, and it's really one of the very few bits of comedy in the movie. So the president is coming to town for the dedication of this wing at a local library for her husband, for Tess's husband, and so with the president coming, there's like this sense of grandeur, and they almost go into a little bit of like a training montage. Like, we talked about it during The Boy in Blue, like it was sort of like Rocky IV, but I like that this is sort of the training montage for a 60-year-old former first lady.
Yeah, when she was in her room and she opens up her closet and you just see like her closet filled with clothes and dress, I was like, that's kind of like my movie closet filled with DVDs, you know? And then she's like, yeah, this is where she's like getting her hair done, buying dress, getting her nails done. You're right. It's like the old lady equivalent of Rocky IV.
My favorite part of this whole montage is when they're at the grocery store, like she's going shopping, and they're pulling out all the stops of the Secret Service. Like, they clear out the aisles for her. Cage is next to the store manager, talking into, like, the little microphone on his hand, trying to figure out what the price of peas are. Like, it's actual comedy, and I don't know if it's necessarily, like, that funny, but it's funny in a way that I wish we had more of in this movie.
Absolutely, and it feels like it's part of a different draft or something, or a longer cut, because when they come to the supermarket, the manager says to Nick Cage, does she want us to know who she is today or not? So I'm thinking they do this a lot. Maybe they did this before and they didn't have time for it, so they cut it out of the movie, and this was supposed to be a running gag, because if she's such a shut-in, why would he ask if they were supposed to know who she is, if she came there very often? It was all sort of confusing. However, I did like the tone of this sequence.
And like, what's weird about this movie, and I don't remember what other movie in Cage Club we talked about it for, but it's not super long. Like, it's just over an hour and a half. I don't know why these movies feel the need to like cut out scenes that would make us like characters more, that would sort of set them up into a rhythm. You know what I mean? Like, it's not over long and getting cut down. Like, it's almost already at the bare minimum for like what most movies are. Add a couple more scenes in, like show us who these characters are. Set up the moments that come later so that we can enjoy them more, so that we can enjoy the characters more, and get a sense of this world and this movie and all that stuff.
Yeah, I had trouble engaging with this film because it just felt like I was drifting through it. Like, what's even kind of happening? There's really no central cause or conflict. You know, there's no ticking clock. There's no agenda, really. It's just day after day of guarding the First Lady. Imagine my surprise when there's only like 20 minutes left and something extremely important does happen.
Cage and Tess and their driver go out to this field, and they're just sort of having a nice little lunch, sitting out in a field and enjoying nature, and it's the winter. Tess falls asleep, and Cage carries her back to the car, and then he goes back to get the stuff, and they drive off again. And it comes sort of weird, because you saw how angry Cage got earlier in the movie when the driver drove off. And it really doesn't make sense. I'm trying to think, why would Earl drive off again? Doesn't make any sense. And then I'm like, wait a minute, she's asleep, and they show her in the back of the car like she's waking up, like she's groggy, that she didn't tell him to do this. It becomes clear that she was kidnapped.
This was very bizarre. They're out in the middle of some lake. It looks like an album cover. Like, it's a gorgeous shot. It's this old lady, you know, sitting by herself with a little table, having tea by a lake in the rain. Just one of those moments where she's like, oh, I'm gonna die, and like, I'm just thinking about like how much time I got left, and I just want to spend it with my friend the driver and my favorite Secret Service agent. I actually thought she passed away here when Cage came up to her, but no, she's asleep. And yes, when the abduction happens, it's jarring. It's jarring because Tess is asleep when the driver takes off, and usually it's on her command. You know, she's like, right, take off. And also because we've only seen this happen once. You know, it's only set up once. It's not fresh in my mind that, you know, they've got a habit of doing this, especially now that Tess and Doug have sort of made up.
When they first take off, Cage, like, walks to town, takes a couple hours to walk to town, calls the house and says, hey, are they back yet? And they said, no, they're not back yet. And Cage is concerned, and they send a car to pick Cage up, and they get back to the house, and she's still not there. And so it's really at this point that they realize, now we really officially realize, this is not like a joke, this is not a comedy, it's a massive tonal shift, she's actually been kidnapped. And so they call in the FBI, they call in James Rebhorn, the guy from Independence Day and a whole bunch of other stuff, and they're trying to figure out who would take her, why somebody would take her, you know, what was the motive behind all this?
This is crazy. What happened to this movie? It's like, I expected something kind of bad to happen at the end, but I didn't think it was going to be like an all-out kidnapping, like, you know, call in Tommy Lee Jones to save the day type of thing. Like, they call in all these agents, and you just get the sense that Cage is sort of like Jodie Foster in Contact. They're pushing him to the side of the investigation. Like,
right.
He's being pushed away. Like, you know, this is sort of his fault, all that kind of stuff. And it's hitting him, too. Like, he feels the guilt, you know. He's really not taking it too well. I'll be damned if he doesn't get in there and do some of his own investigating.
And so the clues are as such, that the driver has two little burn marks on the back of his neck. There was, like, a syringe that was supposedly knocked him out in the back seat of the car. And there's a ransom note for $15 million in the glove box. And nothing really adds up, and they're throwing out a lot of theories, and nothing really makes sense. Nick Cage, like you were saying, sort of does his own little investigation, figures out that the burn marks probably match the cigarette lighter in the back of the car, and so he and James Rebhorn go to the hospital where the driver's being treated, confront him about it, and they're not overly aggressive at first, but they're saying, hey, we have a couple theories, you mind if we ask you a couple questions?
I love the way he comes up with the lighter theory too, because it's just pure instinct and it comes across pretty natural as well. Like, I was sort of saying to myself, what is up with these burn marks? I was like, what burn marks? That's just like so weird. That's just like, sounds like something made up, something they did to the like the driver might have done to himself. And then they're like, oh, the burns are consistent with a known terrorist organization.
Yeah.
Nick Cage is sort of like, they're like, why don't you go home and like get some rest? And he's driving home and his buddy lights a cigarette in the car, and Nick Cage just does like a U-turn in the middle of the road, you know, and does like an immediate turnaround, bursts back into the house and is like, the cigarette lighter. That's when they go to the hospital and they get their torture on.
What I love, and like really honestly, I think the only nice directorial touch this movie, and maybe that's a little bit of exaggeration, but they're showing the guy in bed, they're showing the driver in bed, and you just see Cage's arm and he's just twirling in his hand the cigarette lighter. And like, it's like beautiful framing. And you see the driver have like this moment of panic and moment of realization that the jig is up. The only defense he really has left is he's like, no, man, I loved her. This guy hated her. He didn't want to work here. They always are fighting. You should be looking at him, not at me. James Redborn's like, is this true? And then Cage says, yeah, it's true. But then he takes things up to the next level. He pulls up all the stops to get some answers.
Where is she?
I don't know.
Doc, we're the good guys, okay? We don't do stuff like this.
Look at that. Don't you get it? Don't you get it? I'm the only witness you've got. He wants to kill me. Good God, doesn't that tell you anything?
Come on, Doug. I'm telling you to holster your pistol. Oh,
Jesus, help me.
God damn it, Doug. Put that gun away.
You're already in so much trouble.
He's gonna tell me. Tell you what, I don't know anything.
Even if he does, we can't use it. Not like this.
Girl, I'm going to count to five and then I'm going to shoot one of your toes off.
Oh, God!
Doug.
And then I'm going to count to five and shoot another toe.
Doug!
Listen, I don't know anything. Will you just get that through your thing?
Are you crazy? Are you?
He didn't count!
Five.
He didn't even count!
Four. You're going to prison, Doug.
Listen to me! Will you just listen to me? If he is involved.
This is the nurse's station. Should we call the police?
Yes, ma'am, any FBI.
If he is involved, then she knows it. And if she knows it, her life is worthless. You understand me? They have to fucking kill her. We don't have time to meet his lawyer, right, Earl?
Oh, God, help me.
Five.
Doug.
Four.
No, no, okay.
Three.
Okay.
Two.
Okay, 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 okay. Look, they've got her in an abandoned farmhouse. Okay.
An abandoned farmhouse?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think so.
No,
five.
No, I swear to God. I swear to God, Doug, really, listen, it's my sister and her husband. Check it out, Doug. It wasn't my idea. I swear to God.
I love this hospital sequence. It definitely doesn't fit this movie, but it fits like Serpico or something like that, you know, like a gritty crime film from the 70s. Because you're like you said, with the framing and the staging and the way the guy tries to confess his alibi, and, you know, he thinks he's got it all set up, all the way up until the gratuitous violence. Like, Nick Cage shoots a guy's toe off in a hospital in front of his commanding officer.
It gets real. Real fast. Turns out that, like, they went to some abandoned warehouse out in the middle of nowhere and literally buried her alive.
No, so here's what I thought, that the driver's relatives are just these, like, crazy backwoods hill folk people who live up there in the woods, and this was sort of their farm or their ranch, right? And it's just, like, there's a recession, so the ranch is, it looks like the set from Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Not even joking.
There's no lights anywhere. It's just, like, empty farmhouse, empty something, just dirt everywhere. Everything's in disrepair.
Yeah, and their living quarters, they're like Silence of the Lambs type looking people, you know? They're like Mr. and Mrs. Buffalo Bill. You're right, like the whole SWAT team converges on a pipe sticking out of the ground. I'm like losing my mind. Why and is this movie going here? And I can't believe just how quickly it got there.
It goes from 0 to 60 very, very fast. And what was like ostensibly a comedy is now this really dark sort of revenge movie of Cage trying to get back this woman that it's also kind of like a love story. Like, he's trying to get back the woman. Like, it's all sorts of weird at the end. And, like, nothing really kind of fits. And, like, they start digging for her. And then Cage's like, I need to dig. Like, I need to be the one who does this. And he starts digging. And eventually, like, he rescues her. And they get her out to get her back to a hospital. Helicopter shows up. You know, Cage loves those helicopters, right? A little bit of Firebirds action right there.
It's just, like, crazy because this movie's, like, five types of genres slammed together. And you can just see the dividing line every time. So I just wish it was Nicolas Cage, call him in, because the First Lady's been kidnapped and he's the only one that can save her because he's the one that protected her husband, you know, 5 years ago. You know what I'm saying? Like, that is the movie.
The last 20 minutes of this movie are pretty good, but they're just, they don't, like you said, they don't fit this movie. It doesn't make sense. It wraps up, like, in a nice, neat little bow, like she survives and she wants to make sure that he's on the plane. And so they call his name in this little, like, telephone game. They get him on the plane, and the pilot kicks off a bunch of the FBI guys and let all the Secret Service on. They have, like, a nice little moment that she's like, oh, you finally got to shoot a man? They're like, oh, I was in his toe. And she's like, nah, that's disappointing.
And then there's, like, one more little wrap-up scene when she's getting out of the hospital, and, like, the president calls, and she's like, no, like, he's like a son to me. He's going to stay. You know, I love my Dougie.
Yes, are they treating you all right in that hospital? Because if they're not...
Harold, I want this Secret Service agent of mine taken care of.
Yes, the man discharged a firearm in a public place.
I don't care about any of that. This young man saved my life. He's like a son to me, Harold. I want him taken care of, you understand?
Well, sure, Tess. I'm sure we...
Oh, and if anything should ever happen to me, I want your personal word that you... look after him.
Well, sure, Tess. You know, I...
Good. Thanks, Harold. That's all I wanted to know. You have yourself a nice day.
Yes, ma'am.
I love it, too, because it just... It's... That is the director again coming in at the end, right? And he's wrapping up his little thread there, right? He's been a little running gag throughout the whole movie, and he even knows, you know, to tie himself up like a little bow at the end right there before it ends.
I really like that it's very clear that the chain of power is Nicolas Cage at the bottom, and then the president above him, and then Tess above him. Like, Tess is the most powerful person in the world in this, even more powerful than the president, and that she can sort of dictate what he does.
I even love the final shot where she's leaving the hospital, she's sort of being wheeled away, and everyone's smiling and laughing and, you know, waving goodbye, but you see Nick Cage up in the side of the screen, just ever vigilant, looking as serious as can be, just, you know, watching, always watching.
It's quite an ending to a very strange movie. As weird as this movie is, Shirley MacLaine received a Golden Globe nomination for Best Actress in a Musical or Comedy. Like, she's good in this movie, but also, what? Like,
she's like, okay. I don't know. It kind of felt like the movie didn't have any pep to it. It felt like a car running out of gas the whole time. Like, no one's performance really elevated any of the material. She was okay.
But that's Guarding Tess. That is this weirdo kind of movie. Not necessarily the comedy we thought we were getting between Deadfall and Leaving Las Vegas in this little stretch of three comedies, but I guess a comedy nonetheless?
I just felt like maybe if they scored it a bit differently and sort of had a little more musical accent when the laughs are supposed to be, or if they even just went out and like added a laugh track to this movie so we could know what was supposed to be funny. I'm sort of giving it a hard time, but yeah, by no means is it a flat-out comedy. There's something else happening here.
I can't really recommend this movie. I don't think it's great. I mean, it's fine sort of for whatever it is, and whatever it is this muddled mess of genres, but it's not one that you should really, I don't think, go seek out. I mean, Cage is fine in it, and he has a couple little freak-out moments, but like we were saying earlier, like, the whole movie is him trapped in this job he doesn't want to do, and so he's bored, and we're kind of bored because he's bored.
I might recommend watching the first 5 minutes and then the last 25 minutes so you can just see the way they set up the film and the way they end the film, and just what a completely parallel tone they ended on.
That's fine. I mean, the middle hour, though, is really not necessarily worth watching. So go to cageclub.me for all things Cage Club. You can read the reviews that we write for every movie. You can listen to all the podcasts, follow us on Twitter, subscribe on iTunes, all that good stuff. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And we'll see you next time on Cage Club.